Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, March 18th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. On the front page, Thursday's Globe Gazette, is a photograph of the property at 607 South Johnson Street in Charles City, which is being considered for demolition as part of the city's blight cleanup initiative. The accompanying story is written by Jared McNett of the Globe Gazette and titled Charles City to Tackle Nuisance Properties. When the Mason City Council set its agenda for 2021, one of the top priorities it identified was blight enforcement. Prior to the meeting, the city's intent was to address at least 40 nuisance properties before the year ended. Its plan to reach the number was to work with property owners when possible and go to court to take title and do a demolition as a final resort. Soon enough, Charles City is looking to do the same. At a planning meeting on March 10th, Charles City Administrator Stephen Dyers shared with the five-member council that the city was working through the mediation process with a property on South Johnson Street. In Chapter 657 of the Iowa Code, it spelled out how and when a city can petition for the title of a property. Reasons include dense vegetation, obstruction of nearby infrastructure, and being a danger to the health and safety of the public. For the property in question, Dyers told the council it's been considered a nuisance for several years. Quote, "We're going to be looking into acquiring that property and then look to demo," he said. To build off of that, Dyers added that the city intends to develop a new list of nuisance properties to try and address. According to him, the last time Charles City developed such a list was in 2019. Quote, "You should be seeing something along these lines in the upcoming weeks," Dyers said. At the council meeting on Monday night, Mayor Dean Andrews gave a slight update on the abatement process. Quote, "Everything is proceeding along there," he said. Dyers then added that he thought the city would have an offer in the process by now. Bonding. During that same meeting, the city council unanimously approved loan and debt service levies for so-called, quote, "general and essential corporate purposes," end quote, in fiscal year 2022 that include $40,000 for nuisance abatement and total $300,000, The largest listed expense was $60,000 for the ambulance bay remodel at the fire station, followed by the aforementioned abatement needs, and then $33,333 for a capital project for the learning center. According to the packet for the meeting, city officials anticipate that, quote, "principal and or interest will come due on the bonds before July 1, 2022, end quote. While discussing the item, Councilmember Delane Friesman asked Dyers if the action taken by the city was akin to actions taken in previous years. Quote, "at least the last seven," Dyers said, in reference to the time he's logged for the city. Stormwater. Late in Monday night's meeting, the city council signed off on setting a public hearing for April 19th to award a six-figure contract for an infrastructure project. According to Dyers, city officials are looking to redo a portion of Grove Street that's had a lot of erosion issues. To do the work, a portion of existing pavement and storm sewer at the intersection of Grove Street and Illinois Street will be removed. Then, a new storm sewer and added intakes will route collected water runoff to Sherman Creek. Per an estimate from city engineer John Fallis, the total cost of the work for the city should be $109,000. Water recovery. The Grove Street item wasn't the only water work the council advanced on Monday, as the group also unanimously approved a payment of $274,000, $156.20 for continued construction on the Water Resource Recovery Facility project. Overall costs for the project have been budgeted for $19 million, and the target completion date is the end of 2021. However, the material found in the council packet notes that the extreme cold in the month of February caused a decrease in equipment and material deliveries to the construction site. In other top stories, Jared McNett reports City Hall reopening Monday. CG Health soon to accommodate new vaccine eligibility. After more than 3 months of being effectively closed to the public, Mason City Hall will soon reopen. During a Wednesday afternoon press conference with CG Public Health Director Brian Hanft, Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel announced that members of the public would be allowed in the building with masks after checking in at the front desk on Monday, March 22nd. When discussing the news, Hanft said he was excited about the excitement. Quote, "It's definitely time. I'm happy we're at that point," said Hanft. City Hall is far from the only public building that residents will soon be able to visit again. Schickel also shared that the Mason City Public Library will begin accepting walk-in browse by appointment in April, though no date has been set yet. Along with the library opening, Schickel pointed out that the Charles H. McNider Art Museum is currently accepting visitors by appointment. To add to all of that, Schickel reiterated a conversation from Tuesday night's Mason City Council meeting that the Mason City Aquatic Center will reopen sometime in June. On the vaccine front, Hanft said that Governor Kim Reynolds' announcement that all Iowans will be eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine starting April 5th won't significantly alter how CG Public Health is currently handling vaccination efforts. Quote, "We have the capacity to push well over 1,000 people through our site," Hanft said. "We can increase the number of providers administering the vaccine. I think our system is set up where we could increase the number of days," end quote. A day prior, Hanft informed the Cerro Gordo County Board of Supervisors that the Mason City Walmart Pharmacy could see vaccines as early as April 5th. To him, more places in town getting doses can only help alleviate any pressure on the department. In the long run, as more vaccines become available to pharmacies and to CG Public Health, Hanft said that the role of the department will start to shift somewhat. Quote, "The longer-term plan is to start stepping back in the next 2 to 4 months from administration and just handling the distribution of it," he said. But for now, Hunt said, the plan is to do more than 800 vaccinations for a clinic on Friday and then offer 800 primary doses of Moderna the following week. Through Tuesday, there have been 6,662 COVID-19 vaccine series completions for Cerro Gordo County. Lisa Gruet of the Globe Gazette reports Mason City emergency services respond to downtown accident. Mason City's police, fire, and ambulance services responded to the scene of a two-vehicle crash on Wednesday in which one vehicle was tipped on its side, leaving a woman trapped in the driver's seat. The collision occurred just before 11:30 a.m. at the intersection of 2nd Street Southeast and South Delaware Avenue near Southbridge Mall and Midas. A witness at the scene said her husband and another bystander tried to help the two in the tipped Chevy Malibu as first responders were called and were able to pull a boy from the passenger side of the car. The boy told paramedics he was not hurt. Firefighters could be heard speaking to the woman, explaining that they were going to stabilize the vehicle so they could get her out. A saw was then used to cut the windshield out of the car, and responders used a blade to cut through airbags before pulling the woman to safety. The woman was taken by ambulance to the hospital. The driver of the second vehicle, a BMW hatchback, told police he was uninjured. However, the front end of his car was damaged in the crash. Officers could be seen taking statements from a number of witnesses in an effort to determine the cause of the collision. A Wednesday afternoon call to the Mason City Police Department on the status of the investigation was not returned. In Cerro Gordo's daily COVID-19 update for Wednesday, March 17th, this is a data snapshot as of 10 a.m. Total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state stood at 371,794. Total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo County as of March 17th, 5,418. Total recovered in the county, 4,846. As of March 17th, there were statewide 5,657 deaths in Iowa and 85 deaths in Cerro Gordo. 14-day positivity rate in Cerro Gordo County as of March 17th was 3.9%. In vaccination information, COVID testing options in the county include Mercy One Family Health Line, 641-428-7777, Quick Care Urgent Care Clinic, 641-450-7000, Mason City Community Health Center, 641-450-0601, Waypoint Medical, 641-357-1999, and Test Iowa, 641-832-3500. Rod Boshart, special to the Globe Gazette, reports federal aid could ease preschool losses. Republican senators are working with Governor Kim Reynolds to direct federal money to cover a projected $7 million shortfall that hit Iowa preschools when enrollments dropped as parents kept their kids home during the COVID-19 pandemic. Senator Amy Sinclair, a Republican from Allerton, chair of the Iowa Senate Education Committee, told a subcommittee meeting Tuesday she is working with the governor's office to use federal early childhood dollars as part of a measure being formulated to provide one-time supplemental school funding to help districts that incurred costs related to the pandemic, the August 10th derecho, and other challenges. The Senate amendment also would provide money to area education agencies that incurred COVID-19-related expenses while serving districts with in-person learning, she added. Sinclair said proposed changes are being formulated to a $27.2 million Iowa House-passed bill that would provide one-time money to use for so-called qualified K-12 instruction costs incurred by 327 school districts that were hit with extra pandemic expenses for cleaning, transportation, and other needs at a time they also suffered from, quote, depressed certified enrollments, end quote. House File 532 proposed to make the supplemental funds available yet this fiscal year, but Sinclair indicated a Senate amendment could peg implementation for the 2022 fiscal year beginning July 1st. The House plan also differed from a previously passed Senate version that would have provided funds for 326 districts, but not Des Moines, and included language to treat schools that did not have in-person instruction because of derecho damage as if they were in session. Quote, most districts are going to see the need for dollars in the next fiscal year, so we will be looking at getting those dollars out after the beginning of the 2022 fiscal year, so those monies go in when the depressed certified enrollment actually hits budgets, Sinclair said during a Senate Education Subcommittee that forwarded the legislation to the full committee for additional work. However, Kelly Augustine Donnelly, a preschool administrator in Des Moines, expressed concerns that preschools would have to look at laying off teachers or turning parents away if more aid is not forthcoming until July 1st. Quote, my budget is literally written in crayon, said Donnelly. Quote, we want something that's going to give us stability, she told subcommittee members. The not knowing has been the stressful part for everybody, end quote. Spokespeople for education groups representing school boards, administrators, and teachers urged senators to scrap a House-passed funding formula under which districts that had the most in-person classes would receive the largest share of funding and to instead favor an approach making per-pupil allocations. Regardless of whether schools use remote, in-person, or a hybrid of the two models, said Emily Piper of the Iowa Association of School Boards, quote, costs were still being incurred, and we would like to see the complicated formula in the House bill taken out and distribute money on a straight per-pupil basis, end quote. Margaret Buckton, representing urban and rural school districts, said districts providing remote and hybrid learning had costs associated with technology, training, substitute teachers, and staff disruptions that would be complicated to enumerate under the House-passed approach. Quote, the districts that got approved for hybrid or all remote were the ones that were hardest hit by the pandemic, said subcommittee member Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames. Quote, but it seems that they get the least support here, end quote. The Ames Democrat said he was supportive of the changes Sinclair discussed Tuesday, but wanted the time frame currently proposed from July 1st through January 29th to be extended for the full year since schools are still being impacted by COVID-19 issues and may have classes run longer into May or possibly June. Senator Tim Goodwin, a Republican from Burlington, said he wanted to know how much additional money K-12 schools in Iowa might receive from the $1.9 trillion federal stimulus plan in deciding an appropriate level for state supplemental funding. Sarah Skidmore-Sell of the Associated Press reports in the Globe Gazette, IRS delaying tax filing deadline by over a month. Americans will be getting extra time to prepare their taxes. The Internal Revenue Service says it's delaying the traditional tax filing deadline from April 15th until May 17th. The IRS announced the decision Wednesday and said it would provide further guidance in the coming days. The move provides more breathing room for taxpayers and the IRS alike to cope with changes brought on by the pandemic. Quote, the IRS wants to continue to do everything possible to help taxpayers navigate the unusual circumstances related to the pandemic, while also working on important tax administration responsibilities, IRS Commissioner Chuck Rettig said in a statement. The decision postpones when individual taxpayers must file their return and when their payment is due. The IRS said taxpayers who owe money would not face any further penalties or interest if they pay by May 17th. The new deadline also applies to individuals who pay self-employment tax. Taxpayers do not need to take any action to take advantage of the new deadline. Those who need more time beyond May 17th can request an extension until October 15th. Returning to state news, Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau reports all eligible for shots starting April 5th. Additional cases of COVID-19 UK variant confirmed in Iowa. All Iowans should be eligible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine starting April 5th, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday. Reynolds said so long as the federal government fulfills its projected allotment of vaccine doses to Iowa in the meantime, the state will open eligibility for the vaccine to all Iowans. Quote, "Getting vaccinated is the most important thing that each of us can do to ensure that our state's recovery from COVID-19 is both strong and sustainable. We all want life to be back to normal," Reynolds said Wednesday during her weekly news conference at Iowa PBS Studios. Reynolds said widespread vaccination is the key to Iowa businesses rebounding, in-person graduation ceremonies being held, full attendance at churches, and families reuniting. Quote, "All these things are possible, and soon, but like everything else this past year, it will depend on all of us doing our part for the greater good," Reynolds said, encouraging all Iowans to pledge to get vaccinated and encourage their family, friends, and coworkers to do the same. Iowans who would become eligible on April 5th should not yet attempt to schedule a vaccination appointment. Reynolds said she will provide another update next week after another conference call with federal officials. As of Wednesday afternoon, more than 425,000 Iowans have completed their COVID-19 vaccination, and another 320,000-plus have received the first dose of the vaccines that require two doses, according to state public health data. A supply of the vaccine has been limited since the rollout started in December. The state prioritized different population groups to become eligible to receive the vaccine. It started with healthcare workers and long-term care residents and staff, then expanded to include older Iowans, first responders, teachers and education staff, food processing and manufacturing workers, and correctional facility staff and incarcerated individuals. Eligibility earlier this month was expanded to include any adult Iowans with a serious health condition. Roughly 2.1 million Iowans are 18 or older. Moderna and Johnson & Johnson's vaccines are authorized for people ages 18 and up, while Pfizer's has been cleared for those 16 and up. Reynolds and Interim State Public Health Director Kelly Garcia expressed confidence the state and local public health departments, in conjunction with private health care partners, will be prepared for the influx of Iowans hoping to make a vaccine appointment starting April 5th. Garcia said the capacity to move more doses is there. The challenge has been having sufficient supply to distribute. Quote, "We're working on it every day, every single day," Reynolds said. She said the state is constantly working with different partners in the private business and nonprofit sectors in order to expand the distribution of vaccines as more doses become available. Quote, "We're continually looking for those partnerships," end quote. A spokeswoman for the Public Health Department in Polk County, the state's most populous, said the county, in conjunction with its healthcare partners, has the capacity to vaccinate 50,000 people per week. Quote, "We are well positioned to administer an increased number of doses in Polk County," spokeswoman Nola Agner Davis said. More variant cases. An additional 38 cases of the COVID-19 variant have been confirmed by the state Public Health Department. Infectious disease experts believe this new variant of the virus, often called the UK variant because it was first detected there, spreads more rapidly. Early testing indicates the existing COVID-19 vaccines are effective against the new variant. The state public health department encouraged Iowans to get the COVID-19 vaccine as soon as it is available and to continue to practice safe public health behaviors like washing hands, maintaining 6 feet of social distance, wearing a face covering in public, and staying home when feeling sick. And in the Looking Back section of today's Globe Gazette, for Thursday, March 18th, the 77th day of 2021, there are 288 days left in the year. Highlight in history for March 18th, in 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court in Gideon v. Wainwright ruled unanimously that state courts were required to provide legal counsel to criminal defendants who could not afford to hire an attorney on their own. On this date 10 years ago, President Barack Obama demanded that Muammar Gaddafi halt all military attacks on civilians and said that if the Libyan leader did not stand down, the United States would join other nations in launching military action against him. At a massive demonstration against Yemen's government, snipers fired on protesters and police blocked an escape route. Dozens were killed, including children. Former Secretary of State Warren M. Christopher died in Los Angeles on this date at 85. And Princess Antoinette of Monaco, the late Prince Rainier's III's oldest sister and a prominent advocate for animal rights, died at 90. On this date 5 years ago, a jury in St. Petersburg, Florida, sided with ex-pro wrestler Hulk Hogan, awarding him $115 million in compensatory damages in his sex tape lawsuit against Gawker Media. 3 days later, the jury awarded $25 million in punitive damage. Gawker, which ended up going bankrupt, finally settled with Hogan for $31 million. Police in Brussels captured Europe's most wanted fugitive, Salah Abdeslam, who was the prime suspect in the deadly 2015 Paris attacks. North Korea ignored UN resolutions by firing a medium-range ballistic missile into the sea. And 1 year ago, on March 18th, the U.S. and Canada agreed to temporarily close their shared border to non-essential travel. Describing himself as a so-called wartime president, President Donald Trump said he would invoke emergency powers to let the government steer production of needed medical supplies by private companies. Trump signed a $100 billion aid package to boost testing for the coronavirus and guarantee sick leave to workers who become ill. As fears of a prolonged recession caused by the virus took hold, the S&P 500 sank 5%. The Dow shed more than 1,300 points and had lost nearly all of the big gains posted since Trump's inauguration. Returning to news from the state capitol in today's Globe Gazette, James Q. Lynch, special to the Globe Gazette, writes, "Nearly united Iowa House backs free speech bill." The Iowa House voted nearly unanimously Tuesday to support legislation requiring Regents universities to protect First Amendment rights, but split along party lines on another bill addressing training and teaching about so-called divisive concepts such as racism, sexism, and political ideology. There was little disagreement that free speech is important in education, quote, "because that is when the young folks of our state are developing their own thoughts and ideas," Representative Dustin Height, a Republican from New Sharon, said about House File 744. "It's not the job of educators in educational institutions, quote, to tell those kids what to think," he said, "but, quote, to give them the tools to decide what to think, not come down on one side or the other, but to give them both sides of the argument, the ability to see all sides and decide for themselves," end quote. The House agreed 97-1, with Representative Jade Jacoby, a Democrat from Coralville, casting the lone no vote. "It's not that he doesn't support free speech for students and the employees of K-12 schools and universities," he said, "but he doesn't believe the bill furthers those rights." Quote, "In fact," Jacoby said, "it is code clutter that smells of Big Brother. The core question is why it is needed. In my opinion, it ain't," end quote. The bill is similar to Senate File 478, which was approved 33-14 earlier this year. The language of SF 478 is nearly identical to an executive order from then-President Donald Trump that identified so-called divisive concepts. University of Iowa Dental School Dean David Johnson touched off a controversy when he denounced Trump's order and called for a disciplinary hearing for a student who publicly supported the executive order. After free speech incidents at Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa, the Board of Regents subsequently discussed free speech issues on its campuses and said it will move ahead with creating a free speech committee to guide policies and review complaints. Quote, "education training," end quote. But there was no bipartisan support for a so-called education training bill, House File 802, to prohibit teaching of divisive concepts such as political ideology, one's moral character being determined by one's race or sex, that the United States and Iowa are fundamentally or systematically racist and sexist, and that meritocracy or traits such as a work ethic are racist or sexist. Talking about divisive concepts can be a good thing, Representative Mary Wolf, a Democrat from Clinton, said, because it helps people learn other viewpoints. Some of the concepts, such as one race or sex being superior to another, are ridiculous, she said, and should not be taught. End quote. HF 802 originally was targeted at Regents institutions, but amended to include all governmental agencies and political subdivisions that provide mandatory staff or student training. The bill specifically would allow divisive topics to be a part of a larger course of academic study and allow courts to order training or remedial action on divisive concepts. House Minority Leader Todd Pritchard, a Democrat from Charles City, called the bill an attempt by the legislature to micromanage other governments. Quote, "We no longer trust these jurisdictions to know what's best for them," he said. Representative Ako Abdul-Samad, a Democrat from Des Moines, thanked Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison, for bringing the bill forward because it opened a conversation, quote, "to challenge each of you in your comfort zone," end quote. Quote, "We can't educate ourselves if we stifle ourselves, if we stifle our teachers," he said. "Ignoring the problem won't make it go away," said Representative Kirsten Running Marcant, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. Bankers' survey for parts of 10 states rockets to record high. The economy in rural parts of 10 plains and western states appears to be on record pace, according to a monthly survey of bankers released Thursday that saw initial indicators soar and the overall index rocket to its highest reading since the survey began in 2006. The overall index of the Rural Main Street Survey shot up more than 18 points to 71.9 in March from February's 53.8. Any score above 50 suggests a growing economy, while a score below 50 suggests a shrinking economy. Nearly 70% of bank CEOs reported their local economies were expanding, while about 31% indicated little or no growth, said Creighton University economist Ernie Gross, who oversees the survey. Quote, "Sharp gains in grain prices, federal farm support, and the Federal Reserve's record low interest rates have underpinned the rural Main Street economy," Gross said. Components of the survey also saw drastic jumps, with the hiring index soaring to 72.9 from 51.9 in February, and the farmland price index climbing from 60 last month to 71.9 in March, its highest level since November 2012. For the first time in 6 months, bankers reported an expansion in loan volumes, with that index increasing to 60.9 from February's 46.1. Bankers' economic optimism looking ahead 6 months also grew. The survey's confidence index leapt to 76.7 from February's 64.0. Again, this survey is of bankers from Colorado, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And save the date, Saturday, August 7th. Main Street Mason City is partnering up with KCMR Radio to host a demonstration of gratitude. Project Gratitude will be held Saturday, August 7th from 10 a.m. to noon in Mason City's Central Park. The park will be filled with signs expressing single words that reflect the community's gratitude and positivity. Businesses, organizations, faith groups, or individuals interested in participating or learning more information can email Ozzie Ohl at KCMR Radio at Ozzie, that's O-Z-Z-I-E, at KCMRFM.com. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, March 18, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Barbara A. O'Brien lived September 21, 1946 through March 14, 2021. Barbara A. O'Brien, aged 74, of Mason City, passed away Sunday, March 14, at the Muse Norris Hospice Inpatient Unit in Mason City. Mass of Christian burial will be held 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 19, at Epiphany Parish St. Joseph Catholic Church, 302 5th Street Southeast, Mason City, with the Reverend Josh Link, celebrant. Visitation with viewing will be held Thursday evening, March 18th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hogan Bramer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. A scriptural wake service will begin at 7 p.m. Should friends desire, memorials may be left in Barb's honor to Mercy One North Iowa Hospital or Newman Catholic School. The daughter of George Duff and Jane Rosen Duff, Barbara Ann was born on September 21, 1946, in Phoenix, Arizona. She grew up in Mason City and attended Newman Catholic School, graduating in 1964. Following high school, Barbara attended St. Joseph Mercy School of Nursing and graduated in the final class of 1967. On September 30, 1967, Barb was united in marriage to Patrick O'Brien at Holy Family Catholic Church, Mason City. Together they would be blessed with 4 children and 53 years of marriage. Barb would prove to be a familiar face at Mercy Hospital and Regency Clinic in Mason City, where she worked from 1967 through her retirement in 2012. The best of times for Barb were spent with her family. She adored time with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Countless memories were made at the family cabin on the lake, where days were spent fishing, boating, and enjoying family time together. Barb also enjoyed reading, vacations, coffee with friends, and watching The Price is Right. Barb will always be remembered for her compassion and acceptance to all. She was the family matriarch and always had a listening ear to those in need. Those grateful in sharing her life are her husband, Patrick O'Brien of Mason City, children Chris and Jim Brayton of Lee Center, Minnesota, Andy and Jody O'Brien of Georgetown, Texas, Kathleen and Charles Green of Clear Lake, Iowa, and Sarah O'Brien of Mankato, Minnesota. Beloved grandchildren, Tanner and Carrie, Connor, Gabby and Dan, Bailey and Austin, David, Theodore, Christian, Jaden, Amia, Julian, Maura, and Raina. Great-grandchildren, Braden and Eleanor, her sister, Mary Duff and David, brother-in-law, Joseph Baraji, and nephews, as well as extended family and many friends. Barb is preceded in death by her parents, father and mother-in-law, Dick and Sarah O'Brien, sister, Sharon Massey, sister-in-law, Mary Baraji, and nephew, Scott Baraji. Arrangements by Hogan Bramer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City. Richard L. Fairbanks, age 99, of Mason City, passed away Tuesday, March 16th, at Good Shepherd Health Center. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 20th, at the St. James Lutheran Church, with Pastor Sid Bowles officiating. Interment will follow in the Elmwood Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 until 6 p.m. Friday, March 19th, at the Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City. Online condolences may be left for the family at the website majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Leroy Dale Stonecipher was born on May 7, 1931, to William Henry Stonecipher and Belma Beatrice Quinby Stonecipher. He passed away on March 16th at the Riceville Family Care and Therapy Center in Riceville, Iowa. A private burial service will be held on Saturday, March 20th at Riverside Cemetery in Riceville for immediate family only. A celebration of life service will be held at the Grace United Methodist Church in Floyd on April 17th at 10:30 a.m. with lunch immediately following the service. Hint Hudak Funeral Home of Riceville is assisting the family. Leroy grew up on the family farm in Floyd County. He graduated from Floyd High School in 1949. Before joining the Air Force in 1951, he attended Iowa State University. Leroy was stationed in San Antonio, Texas, and was trained for work in the motor pool. He was stationed in Japan and Korea for over a year, working in the motor pool and doing guard duty. Upon his discharge from the Air Force, Leroy farmed with his uncle for several months. On December 29, 1956, Leroy was married to Jean Jensen at the Grace United Methodist Church in Floyd. Shortly after their marriage, they moved to Chicago in order for Leroy to attend Coin Electrical School on the GI Bill. Their daughter, Kelly Marie, was born during their stay in Chicago. On completion of school, the family returned to the Charles City area, where Leroy accepted employment as an electrician with the Oliver White Farm Equipment Corporation. Leroy became hooked on bicycling while
daughter Kelly was in high school and asked him to go on Ragbri with her. It was the second Ragbri, and so he agreed to go on a ride for a couple of days. He became addicted and rode Ragbri more than 20 times. His biggest bicycle adventure came in 1992. He retired from White Farm in 1991 and started training for the Lon Halderman Pack Tour Ride Across America. The 1992 ride began in Everett, Washington, and ended in Jamestown, Virginia. The ride was 3,400 miles long and was ridden in 23 days. Leroy was by far the oldest participant at the age of 61. He rode on many, many more rides throughout his riding career and made friends everywhere he went. Leroy was preceded in death by his parents, a sister, Anita Marie, and a brother, Claire Edwin. Living family members include his wife, Jean, daughter, Kelly Marie Stonecipher Pfluge, son-in-law, Bob Pfluge, granddaughter, Jennifer Pfluge, grandson, Andrew Pfluge, and his wife, Megan Warburton Pfluge, and their three children, Evelyn, Hunter, and Ashton. He is also survived by a sister, Diane Stonecipher Remker, and her husband, Tom Remker, and by many nieces and nephews. The family requests no flowers. Memorials may be directed to the family. Suzanne M. Mega, aged 78, of Northwood, passed away Monday, March 15th, in Waterloo after a tragic car accident. A massive Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 19th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, 410 North Broadway, in Manly, with Father Neil Lanternock, celebrant. Interment will be in Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery beside her husband, Robert. A live stream of the services can be found on Facebook at Hogan Bramer Moore Colonial Chapel. Visitation and public viewing will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 18th, at Connor Colonial Chapel, 1008 First Avenue South in Northwood. The rosary will be said at 6:30 p.m., followed by a scriptural wake service. Suzanne Margaret Stringer was born November 27, 1942, in Brooklyn, New York, the daughter of George and Claire McMenamin Stringer. She attended Northport High School in New York, graduating in 1960. Sue found her calling soon after at Caledonia Hospital, where she became an LPN and began her career caring for others. On July 11, 1964, she married Robert Mega at the St. Philip Neri in Northport, New York, and to this union, two children were born, Keith Robert and Christine Marie. The family soon made their home in Iowa, where Sue worked for Mercy Medical Center, Lutheran Retirement Home, and later at the Northwood Kensett Schools for many years. Sue was a longtime member at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Manly. She was very active in Rosary Society, acting as a past president, a lector, Eucharistic minister, and was part of St. Anne's and Our Lady of Victory Guild. In 2007, she and Bob traveled to Italy with Father McAndrew to see the Pope, a lifelong dream fulfilled for both. Most of all, Sue loved her family, especially her girls, and her beloved four-legged companion, Deacon II. Those left to cherish her memory are her two children, Keith and Lynn Mega of Minot, North Dakota, and Christine and John Rasmussen of Marshalltown. Two grandchildren, Catherine and Sean Cavalier Mega, and Brianna and Kyle Grohn Rasmussen, great-granddaughters Kaylin and Skyler, siblings Hugh and Marta Stringer of Massachusetts, Jean and James Barry of Massachusetts, and Bernard and Connie Stringer of New York, many nieces and nephews, and many extended family members and friends. Greeting her in heaven is her husband Robert, parents George and Claire, and her siblings George and William Stringer. Arrangements by Connor Colonial Chapel. Mary Watson, aged 84, of Clear Lake, died Wednesday, March 17th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. Arrangements are pending at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 First Avenue North in Clear Lake. In local sports news, Gunnar Davis of the Globe Gazette reports on the Globe Gazette's all-area picks in prep basketball. Some of the top boys basketball players in the state play here in North Iowa. And this year's boys basketball season saw no shortage of excitement. Two area teams, Clear Lake and Lake Mills, ended their seasons down at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. West Fork joined those two teams as regular season conference champions. This is a roster of some of the top players in the area during this season, picked by the Globe Gazette's sports staff. While there's certainly more than 10 players from the area who could be included on this roster of standouts, these 10, in no particular order, were some of the top performers all season long. Corey Miner from Mason City. Junior guard Corey Miner was the obvious leader of a young Mason City team this year. Miner averaged 20.7 points per game and shot 36.4% from behind the three-point line. He also led his team in steals, 43. Although the Mohawks' record was 5-17 overall, Miner's solid play against tough CIML competition showed just how talented he is. Andrew Formanek of Clear Lake. Andrew Formanek, a 6'6" forward, was dominant down low for the Lions. He averaged a double-double with 17.5 points and 13 rebounds per game. The Iowa State football commit also finished the year with 39 blocks and was a large reason why the Lions secured a North Central Conference title and another state tournament berth. Along the way, Formanek and fellow guard Carson Toby each joined the 1,000 Career Points Club at Clear Lake. Eric Bobinet from Osage. In his first year in the starting role, senior forward Eric Bobinet was a tough out for any defender this season. Bobinet averaged 17.3 points, 5.3 rebounds, and 2.6 assists per game. On top of that, he also led his team with 18 blocks. Bobinet's emergence as a standout on a solid Green Devils team is more than enough to earn him a spot on this list. Noah Miller of Forest City. Senior guard Noah Miller was one of the best players in Forest City history. He averaged 16.1 points, 4.3 assists, 2 steals per game, and shot 37.3% from behind the arc. Under his leadership on the court, the Indians made it back to a sub-state semifinal. During his time at Forest City, he became the 7th player in school history to score over 1,000 career points for the program. Deshaun Linen of Lake Mills. Senior forward Deshaun Linen was a large reason why the Bulldogs were ranked so highly all season long and advanced to the 2nd straight state tournament berth. He averaged over 19 points during the regular season and shot 38.4% from behind the arc. This is his 2nd straight season as leading scorer for a Bulldogs team that's only lost 4 times in the past 2 seasons. Doug Taylor of Newman Catholic. Leading the charge for a young Newman Catholic team all season was sophomore forward Doug Taylor. The University of Iowa baseball commit led his team in points, 17.5 points per game, and rebounds, 7.3 rebounds per game. Taylor was the standout member of a balanced Knights roster that finished 2nd in the top of Iowa East. With 2 more years left on the hardwood, expect Taylor to only get better and for his young team to also improve. Carson Toby of Clear Lake. Junior guard Carson Toby teamed up with Formanek to make a formidable 1-2 punch and lead in their team to a 4th straight NCC conference title and another appearance at the state tournament. Toby averaged 19 points per game, 5.4 rebounds, 4.2 assists, and 1.8 steals. He was also 4th in 2A in total 3-pointers made with 72. When Toby shoots, Clear Lake fans expected him to score. Caden Ames of West Fork. In the swan song of his basketball career, senior guard Caden Ames was a sharpshooter all season long. He averaged over 40% from behind the three-point line and was the latest to join the 1,000 career points club in a storied West Fork program. He averaged 15.7 points and 4 rebounds. Ames was a large reason why West Fork earned another Top of Iowa East title. Kevin Myers from Garner Hayfield Ventura. Senior forward Kevin Myers' inclusion to this list shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. Myers was one of the top players in the Top of Iowa West and was a large reason why the Cardinals finished 2nd in the conference. He led his teams in points with 12.5 points per game and rebounds, 7.4 rebounds per game. He was also active defensively, rejecting 25 shots this season. Caleb Bacon of Lake Mills. If you average a double-double on a conference championship team, you're going to make this list. Senior forward Caleb Bacon's physical presence down low punished defenders all season long. He averaged 12.5 points and 10.1 rebounds per game, along with leading his team with 112 total assists. The Iowa State football commit played a massive role in the Bulldogs' success. In the college sports notebook in Thursday's Globe Gazette, Nyack Mentick earns ICCAC pitching honor. Nyack McKenna Mentick was selected as the ICCAC Division II Softball Pitcher of the Week for the week of March 8th through 14th, according to a Nyack release. Mentick, a former Mason City Mohawk, earned the honor for pitching the Lady Trojans to an 11-1 five-inning victory over the Mount Mercy Junior Varsity in the second game of a doubleheader in Cedar Rapids on March 10th. Mentick struck out a career-best 9 with 2 walks and only allowed 2 hits and 1 run for her second collegiate victory. According to the release, she is the first Nyack softball player to win the league's weekly honor since the week of April 1st through 7th, 2019, when sisters Casey Sherwood and Kylie Sherwood were selected as the ICCAC's Player and Pitcher of the Week, respectively. Nyack, with a record of 2-0, is scheduled to return to action Saturday and Sunday at home against Northeast CC in a 4-game ICCAC series. Waldorf Volleyball adds recruits. An already deep and talented recruiting class for the Waldorf University volleyball team just keeps getting better. According to a release, the newest additions to the Warriors' 2021 recruiting class are all-conference performer Maya Benner from Wisconsin and 6-foot middle blocker McKenna Proud from Coralville, who each signed a letter of intent earlier this month. Benner, a 5'5" outside hitter who started all 4 seasons for the Johnson City High School Blue Jays, was second-team all-conference as a senior and honorable mention all-conference as a junior. During her career with the Blue Jays, she recorded 206 kills, 318 digs, and served up 78 aces. She plans to be a defensive specialist when she joins the Warriors as a freshman on the court and in the classroom this coming fall. As for the 6-foot Proud, she is a 3-year letter winner and 2-year starter for Iowa City West High School, who recorded 46 kills and 17 blocks this past season as a middle blocker and right side for the Trojans. In entertainment news, today's Globe Gazette focuses on the 93rd Annual Academy Awards nominations. This is an article by Jake Coyle of the Associated Press. In a year in which the pandemic shuttered movie theaters for months, Academy Awards nominations went to 2 female filmmakers for the first time, and a historically diverse slate of actors Monday, but ultimately, David Fincher's Mank, a very traditional contender about Hollywood itself, took the lead. Fincher's Mank easily topped nominations for the 93rd Academy Awards, delayed 2 months by the coronavirus pandemic, with 10 nominations including Best Picture, Best Director, acting nods for Gary Oldman and Amanda Seyfried, and a host of others for its lavish craft. The rest were spread among a wide variety of contenders. 6 nominations were scored by 6 films, all of which are also up for Best Picture: Judas and the Black Messiah, Nomadland, Minari, Sound of Metal, The Trial of the Chicago 7, and The Father. Also nominated for Best Picture was Emerald Fennell's Promising Young Woman. History was made in the Best Director category, where only 5 women have ever been nominated before. This year, both Chloe Zhao of Nomadland and Fennell got nods. Zhao, the first Asian woman nominated for Best Director, is the most nominated woman in a single year in Oscar history. She was also tipped for the film's adapted screenplay, editing, and as a producer in the Best Picture category. The other directing nominees were Lee Isaac Chung for Minari, Fincher for Mank, and Thomas Vinterberg for Another Round. For performers, it's the most diverse group of nominees ever, and a far cry from the all-white acting nods that spawned the hashtag OscarsSoWhite hashtag 5 years ago. 9 of the 20 acting nominees are people of color, including a posthumous Best Actor nomination for Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, as well as nods for Riz Ahmed, Sound Metal, Steven Yeun, Minari, Viola Davis, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and Andra Hay, The People vs. Billie Holiday, and supporting nominations for Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanford, Judas and the Black Messiah, Leslie Odom Jr. for One Might in Miami, and Yoo Young Yun of For Minari. Davis, who won for her performance in 2016's Fences, landed her fourth Oscar nomination, making her the most nominated Black actress ever. Yun is the first Asian American ever nominated for Best Actor. Judas and the Black Messiah is the first all-Black producing team. Director Shaka King, with producers Ryan Coogler and Charles C. King, nominated for Best Picture. Overall, a record 70 women were nominated for 76 Oscars, the Academy said. Netflix, as expected, led the pack with 35 nominations. The service is still gunning for its first Best Picture winner, and this year has two shots in Mank and The Trial of the Chicago 7, a movie Paramount Pictures sold off during the pandemic. Netflix led last year, too, with 24 nominations, but came away with just two wins. Other streamers were in the mix. Amazon, in particular, was well represented with Sound of Metal, Borat's subsequent movie film, and One Night in Miami, leading to 12 nominations overall. Both Apple TV Plus for Wolfwalkers and Greyhound and Disney Plus for Soul landed their first nominations. Thursday's Globe Gazette also includes the Amy Dickinson column, which continues the Best of Q&A from 10 years ago. Today's column is from May 2011. Virtual dating creates actual problems. Dear Amy, I recently met a wonderful man through an online dating site. He lives in northern Michigan. I live in Minnesota. He is sweet, honest, good, kind, and unspoiled, and we had a very nice, fun time during the weekend he came to my town to visit. Early on, before we spoke on the phone, he warned me that he has a certain kind of northern Michigan or Canadian accent. I responded, "Oh, you don't sound like the people in the movie Fargo, do you?" "Amy, he does, and it really is discordant note to my ears." When I came from a rural area in Wisconsin, and the first thing I worked on when I went off to college was the sloppy diction, etc., that I grew up with. Now no one would guess where I was born. Can I ask him if he'd be willing to work on his accent? Or do I just have to take it or leave it? My friends are divided, and I am torn. Signed, Mystified in Minneapolis. Dear Mystified, as someone whose own accent arguably resides within the Fargo spectrum, I fail to see what is so awful about this, although you obviously find this grating. But when everyone in North America starts to sound like a news anchor, we will have lost something important, not to mention charming. Because your friend brought this up before you two spoke, you have to assume that his accent has been a factor in other encounters and relationships, leading one to assume that he might already be working on it. The nice thing about the initial stages of getting to know someone is that you can raise these questions, these obvious issues, and use your discussion as a way to further your understanding of the person. Today's Marmaduke cartoon features a woman opening a door to a yard filled with dogs waiting to come in the house. She says, quote, "I don't know anything about a parade of homes, kitchen, and refrigerator tour." And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, March 18, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.